Fascinating. That's interesting.
Well, before you leave, I should thank you for agreeing to help me deal with it.
All right. Good afternoon. I hope this is on. It's not very loud, but the acoustics in this room is very good. So my name is Dele Ogunseitan, for those who are visiting for the first time. I am a professor and chair in the program in public health here. I always thank the UCI Extension for helping us videotape this seminar series. And thanks to Shant for being here all the time when we need him, and for producing excellent archive, which is available on our OpenCourseWare website. This seminar series is made possible because many of our faculty and students and sometimes staff have built a tremendous network of colleagues and collaborators and mentors all over the world, and we are delighted to welcome them to our campus, these experts in disciplines of public health. Today's speaker was invited by Professor Brandon Brown, who joined us not too long ago now. He's one of the most energetic members of our faculty, and I'm sure you've already noticed that either in classrooms or the research projects that he mentors students. His picture is currently on the website of the Undergraduate Research Opportunity Program as the Mentor of the Month. This is quite an accomplishment and good visibility for the program. If you have not met him before, taking a class from him, I encourage you to do so. And I'm not going to go too much further into his biography, but in the interest of time, I'm going to ask him to help introduce the speaker for today, Dr. Tom Coates. Please thank Brandon for all he's done for the program, too.
Thank you, Dele. So we're very lucky to have an esteemed speaker here today, a true myth in academia due to his great efforts and accomplishments. His work has facilitated positive changes worldwide, globally, and we all strive to follow his example. Dr. Thomas Coates is the director of the UCLA Program in Global Health and the Michael and Sue Steinberg Endowed Professor of Global AIDS Research within the Division of Infectious Diseases at UCLA. He's also professor of epidemiology in the UCLA School of Public Health and the principal investigator of the GloCal Health Fellowship. The list goes on and on. The director of the Global Capacity Building Core at the Center for HIV Identification, Prevention, and Treatment, and co-director of the UC Global Health Institute. Dr. Coates co-founded the Center for AIDS Prevention Studies, CAPS, at UCSF in 1986 and directed it from 1991 to 2003. He was also the founding executive director of the UCSF AIDS Research Institute, leading it from 1996 to 2003. His areas of emphasis and expertise are in HIV prevention, the relationship of prevention and treatment for HIV, and HIV policies. His domestic work has focused on a variety of populations, and he's currently finishing a nationwide clinical trial of an experimental HIV preventive intervention focused on high-risk men. He's also finishing domestic trials of post-exposure prophylaxis, has funding from USAID and the World Health Organization, and he works in multiple countries across the globe. Tom is co-principal investigator of the NIAID-funded HIV Prevention Trials Network, and he's conducting policy research domestically and internationally. He was cited in Science in 2002 as the fourth highest funded scientist in the clinical, social, and behavioral sciences, and he was elected to the Institute of Medicine in 2000. He has approximately 300 peer-reviewed publications, with his very first early work on insomnia. So I looked this up, and this makes sense given his productivity, and it's time that he's had to achieve all he has achieved. I am fortunate to have established an academic relationship with Dr. Coates. He funded my first trip to Peru when I was doing my MPH at UCLA to look at sites for HIV interventions. And this helped facilitate my connections there, which I later returned to Lima to conduct my dissertation work. Dr. Coates was later my mentor in the postdoc in global health at UCLA, and he continues to mentor me in my research and academic affairs to this day. Dr. Coates is the reason I began working in global health. Today, Dr. Coates will talk about Project ACCEPT, a community randomized clinical trial in Thailand and three African countries to determine the impact of strategies for destigmatization on HIV incidence community-wide. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Coates again to UC Irvine.
Well, good afternoon. It's really a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Brandon, for that very generous introduction. And it's wonderful to see what you're developing here at Irvine. Your chairman said you're energetic. I concur, and you have made incredible and important things happen. So I'm going to talk about NIMH Project ACCEPT, HPTN-043, as we call it, the HIV Prevention Trials Network. The NIH supports these kinds of clinical trials networks. And this is a group of investigators from various and sundry institutions around the world who are brought together to think about the next important studies in HIV prevention. There are, in the HIV field, there's a clinical trials network focused on treatment. There's one focused on vaccines. There's one focused on microbicide development. So this is what they do. And they have these in all fields of diseases, in cancer, in heart disease, and so on and so forth. And I've been fortunate to be able to participate in the HPTN over the last several years. Now, I call this, I presented the main findings of this study at CROI, which is the Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections, and they only give you 10 minutes. But it does represent 10 years' work. Now, that's about half of my lifetime because I'm only 20. But no, I'm just kidding. But, 10 years out of one's life is a long, long time. And, at the end of the study, what you get to do is you just look at a number, and it's one number. And it's like, oh, my God. And so it's a very difficult moment sometimes. So the way this happened was, around early September, the statistician, who was located in Prague, and that's a whole other story, I got up one morning and I opened my email, and there was an email from Mikal. And he said, here are the results of the study. And I thought, I'm not ready for this. There should be horns blaring or trumpets bleeding or something going on. So I opened it up, and there was the result. So then we began to think about how should we, let the world know about these results? Because you don't always want to wait for journal articles. And when you might recall that when President Obama came to office, he had stimulus funding. They were trying to stimulate the economy. And some of that funding went through the NIH. And we applied for and received a stimulus grant of about $1 million to do a feasibility study with a French investigator of penile washing and whether or not penile washing was an effective HIV prevention strategy. Well, Rush Limbaugh caught on to it. And he talked about it and what a waste of government money it was. And then it went to Congress. And several congresspeople, senators, caught a hold of it. And then the next thing I know, we are getting calls from the director of the NIH's office, Francis Collins, and he was going before Congress to justify not only this grant but other grants. There were grants that they gave on things like freezing rat sperm. And, you can sort of look through the titles and you can pick out things that look ridiculous. Well, it turns out freezing rat sperm is a great idea because it's easier than keeping rat colonies alive. It's cheaper. So he wanted talking points, Senator Feinstein wanted talking points. And we kind of got through that storm. Fortunately, the Congress has ADHD, so they don't pay attention for very long to anything. So it moved on to the next issue. Well, so we were thinking about how to release these results. And we were thinking, now we're into sort of late September, early October, and I got a call from my program officer, and she said, we've been talking, I said, oh, really? We've been talking. Who's we? Well, you know, various people at the NIH. I said, oh, okay. What have you been talking about? And she said, well, we're thinking it might be better for a variety of reasons to wait for the presentation of your results. I said, oh, really? How long? She said, well, maybe second week of November, you know? I said, oh, really? What happens before that? Well, she said, you know, maybe even Wednesday of the first week of November would be okay. But we just think you should wait. Well, because they didn't want to raise all the ruckus that happened before, and they thought better to go under the radar on this sort of thing. But, you know, that's been the history of our work in the HIV epidemic. Is sometimes you're above the radar, sometimes you're below the radar. And I just laughed. I said, are you kidding me? She said, yeah. I said, fine, no problem. So we'll just wait. So the mantra of the day is the AIDS-free generation. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton declared that this is the new objective, an AIDS-free generation. Can we actually make that happen? Well, I've had the privilege. I moved to San Francisco in 1982, and HIV was happening. And so, you know, I've seen this disease from the beginning, when nobody knew what it was, until now. How many of you were alive in 1982? I am. You were, but you were a child. Who else? Yeah, you were both children too. So, you know, so you don't remember when all that brouhaha when it started. And it was confusing, and it was difficult, and here was this new disease. And when I was studying public health, the mantra was, well, we've conquered the infectious diseases. Let's move on to the chronic diseases. And then all of a sudden, here comes this infectious disease that nobody had heard about before. What do we do about it? And Ronald Reagan was president at the time. You know, we have the Ronald Reagan UCLA Medical Center, named after Ronnie. It sits within the David Geffen School of Medicine, the only school of medicine in the country and the world named after an openly gay man. Although my friends from Hopkins remind me that Johns Hopkins never got married. So you never know. Anyway, so we're talking about now the AIDS-free generation. So we've seen this thing come full circle. And the fact that we can even talk about an AIDS-free generation, it does make me proud to be an American. Because the U.S. government has invested so much money in this disease, both scientifically and programmatically, that I think we can be proud of what's resulting. Now, before I start, I just wanted to introduce you to my family. This is my partner, Jeff. And what happened? Oh, my gosh, we missed the kids. I don't know what happened to them. They must have gotten taken out. Anyway, they're pictures of the dogs, too. We don't have children, but oh, well, they're cute. So anyway, that's Jeff. So what's happened is, as a result of all this investment, important things have happened. As you can see, there's been investment in children especially. And there's been investment in school attendance for orphans and for non-orphans, because we know that education makes a difference. And you can see what happened in 1993 to 2003 and 2004 to 2009 in the red bars. We now have 5 million people worldwide, almost 6 million people on treatment. And we know that treatment is important not only for treating a person's illness, but it also is good public health, because it prevents transmission, forward transmission onto the next person. So we've made a lot of progress. Now what you'll see down below, down here, which is the pointer?
The very top.
Okay. You'll see down here, this is condom use among males and condom use among females, either the use of the female condom or reported condom use with their partners. I'm glad I'm not a condom marketing person. I'm glad I'm not a condom salesperson. It's a tough, tough, tough sell. Now, obviously it works, but a lot of people just don't like them. But what I do like is when I give talks at USC, I say, hey, how about those Trojans, huh? So, now, what we've learned is that, yes, through PEPFAR, we can treat people, but we really need to get serious about prevention, and we finally have the tools to do that. Now, what do we need to do for HIV prevention? Well, if we think about a comprehensive combination prevention strategy, we need to mobilize communities, we need to encourage widespread HIV testing, and here's the game changer. We now have options for the HIV uninfected as well as options for the HIV infected. because both have to participate in the prevention game. There's behavioral risk reduction for both the infected and the uninfected. We need to provide support and community support because we know these things are not easy to engage in. And what we've learned in the interim since we started this study is we have strategies and devices that work for the uninfected, and we have care and treatment that work for the infected to prevent the spread to other people. So let me talk a little bit about what we did in Project Accept and then what the implications are. So the idea was to destigmatize and normalize HIV testing. We thought that if people really grappled with that reality, that it would change the conversation. It would change who they are. It would change what they do. It includes disclosure, taking advantage of community dynamics, and allow people to be referred to care. You know, HIV is a funny disease. I mean, when you think of it from an evolutionary standpoint, it's very clever. Because you get infected, you might have some flu-like symptoms, and you've got like 8 to 10 years while the person has the virus and feels okay. And it's, you know, they're not all that infectious during that period, but toward the end of that period, they do become infectious again. But they still feel okay before the virus overtakes the immune system and they become sick. So there are periods of infectiousness, and it's invisible. It happens before you know it. Now, the other major challenge in prevention science, and if you understand the science of clinical trials, is understanding what happens in entire communities and not just study cohorts. Many of the advances in prevention we know occur or have occurred because we do these clinical trials. So you recruit a group of people and you randomize them, usually to 2 or 3 groups, and you have to give standard of care, really standard of care plus, to the control group. And then you do the intervention with the intervention group, and you follow them out for a couple, 3 years, and you see what the result is. Well, that's fine in a study cohort. They get very special attention. What happens when you scale it up? And that's what we were interested in doing, and this represents the new generation of HIV science. So I'll tell you what we found, then I'll show you the data, and you can decide if you agree with me. So in the intervention versus the control communities, and you have to understand this is now randomizing communities, we found that rates of testing were higher. We were able to maximize rates of testing. We found that we were able to see reductions in number of sexual partners and multiple sexual partners, and especially among HIV-infected individuals, that we saw higher diagnoses of new HIV infections. We saw changes in social norms, and we saw reductions in HIV incidence, especially among women in the 24 to 32-year-old age group. We did not observe harms in the intervention versus the control communities, and that's important because everybody worries about harms, especially for women who are diagnosed with HIV and their partner is negative, and they could be, they could experience adverse consequences as a result. So here's the design. We recruited 48 communities. Some were randomized to the package of interventions, community mobilization, mobile voluntary counseling and testing, post-test support services, ongoing data feedback, and then standard VCT. And we've written about this. So this is the package. So we have community mobilization over here that brings people in for mobile VCT and also brings people to testing support services, which can be pre-testing, post-testing. And then we have mobile VCT to really bring the service to the individuals. And then there's data. And the data were important. So if you were an HIV test counselor, how many positive results would you rather give in a day? 2 or 8? How many would rather give 2? Raise your hands. And how many would rather give 8? Exactly. That was the problem. It's tough news to give somebody. And so what we had to do was motivate. We had to say, here are the targets. We really want to penetrate the communities. Here's what this group is doing. Here's what that group is doing. you're the last group. What are you going to do? And so we had to really work to motivate the staffs to get to the testing levels that we thought were important. Now, here's the study timeline. And this is also sort of raises the issue of doing this kind of research, because the background changes all the time. And you can kind of see that. So we started, and this is what, it did take 10 years actually. So we started down here in 2001, 2002, doing pilot studies in two countries, Zimbabwe and Thailand. Then we got our full funding, and then we selected the communities, did recruitment, got funding, and then we did randomization of the communities. And that had to be a transparent process. I remember one of the areas we worked in was in Soweto, South Africa. Big, big area of about 2 million people. And we were able to randomize different neighborhoods. And they have a system there of what they call ward counselors. And these ward counselors are responsible for a neighborhood and for an area. This was about 10,000 people. And we were walking around with this gentleman. He was showing us the area. And it was not African National Congress area. It was an Inkatha Freedom Party area, the Zulu Party. And he said, so he showed us around and showed us the miserable conditions. He said, you know, if we were ANC, it would look a lot better, but we're Inkatha Freedom Party. We're the opposition party. We don't get as many resources from the ANC government. What do I need to do to be randomized to the intervention group? I said, well, shall we talk about randomization? No, I understand randomization. I want to know, what do we need to do to make sure it comes out in our favor? So I had a long discussion with him about, well, that really would mess things up. But fortunately, his neighborhood got randomized to the intervention, not through any intervention of any of ours. So then we had 3 years of intervention up here, and then we did the post-intervention assessment. Now, the post-intervention assessment, I'll talk about in a minute, was a sort of unusual for any of these clinical trials. But as you can see, during this period, the whole landscape was changing. So the International AIDS Conference happened in the year 2000 in Durban. It was the first International AIDS Conference held in a low and middle income country, south of the equator. And everybody stood up. And at that meeting, it was all about where you live should not determine whether or not you live with HIV. Everybody should have an equal chance of treatment. And then, later on, Bush was elected in 2002, and then 2003, 2004, he began to put together his PEPFAR program. And it was Bush and the evangelical Christian pastors who said, we have to do something about this. We have an obligation to do something about this for the world. And their first intent was to demonstrate that it could be done. Because everybody said, you can't do this in resource-poor countries. And they demonstrated that it could be done. Then Obama came into office after Bush. Obama came in 2010 and revamped the whole PEPFAR program. But by then, you know, treatment was very, very widespread. So we had this changing landscape of treatment becoming more and more available, which was really a very good change to have happened. So here are the sites. We worked in Vulindlela, South Africa, which is north of Durban on the eastern coast, Zulu area, Soweto, South Africa, in Mutoko, Zimbabwe, which is in northwest Zimbabwe, Kisarawe, Tanzania, south of Dar es Salaam, and Chiang Mai in Thailand in the northern part of the country. This is just gives you an example of some of the community mobilization and community engagement activities where we did participatory mapping and people would identify where things are, developing community maps, and it led to scoping out areas like this where you see where all the resources and services are. Now, these areas are very interesting. This is kind of a hilly area, kind of with communities separated by valleys. And one would wonder, well, you've got eight communities, and if you randomize them to intervention and control, aren't you going to have crossover? Well, in fact, one of the legacies from the apartheid era is that no roads were built between the communities. All the roads were built to lead into town, into Pietermaritzburg and into Durban, because that's where people went to work. And so the communities were relatively isolated, both by geography and as a legacy of apartheid.
Sorry, in the previous slide, were the committee members, not this one, were they trying to geographically locate where...
Yeah, where services were, yeah, various services, be it official health center services or government services or other NGO services and those kinds of things. And that really helped us identify sort of the full strength of things that were ready, or were available. So this gives you a sense of the housing structures. Again, it's a hilly. It can be a very beautiful area. It can also be very cold in the winter, somewhat warm in the summer. And you see, again, a variety of housing structures between the brick and then the thatch and then the mud huts. This is Bulinglela, South Africa. We had a wonderful, wonderful support because in South Africa they have both the civil authorities and then traditional authorities. And this gentleman here, up here, is the Zulu chief. He's the Zulu king. And he gave a very, very stirring speech about how can I lead a nation if the nation is dead? And then he granted us not only his support, but also his protection. So nobody messed with us, which was really, really important. The Zulus have a very wonderful tradition, and that is when the chief or any member, this would be the tribal council, any member is speaking, a member of the Zulu clan, Zulu tribe, gets up and does what's called praise singing. So it's a little bit like what Brandon did for me, except they sing it. And they sort of go on and they sing about all these accomplishments. I said to my staff, I said, I really like that. I think you should learn how to do that. But they didn't. And then the political leaders actually, and this gentleman is a happy gentleman, actually went in and got tested. So they did lead by example as well as by... As well as by encouragement and motivation. We also did event testing. This is an example of a high school, and we had just sort of serendipitously set up the testing tent next to the high school, and the high school kids got involved, and they had a debate. Is it good to be tested? Is it not good to be tested? So they really got energized, and then a lot of them came and got tested, so they were kind of swamping our tent. Thailand required some cultural adaptations, but we also involved the religious leaders. Thailand is a very Buddhist country. We did outdoor concerts. Tanzania was much more rural and required a setup, and we also had to deal with natural hazards. And we also wanted to not hide the service. The idea was to really open up the discussion about HIV because, for example, in Vulinglela, the Zulu area, you could drive into that area on a given Saturday and see within 5 minutes at least four or five funerals going on. And yet people didn't talk about HIV. It was really in the closet. And the idea was to bring it out of the closet and to talk about it and to make it available. And we figured out ways of doing culturally relevant outreach. And then in Soweto, South Africa, which of course is famous for being a center of resistance to apartheid, we went all out with very bright colors, very brilliant colors. And that's Chris Gordon, who was our project officer, some very various community mobilization activities, and you can see the brightly colored mobile vans. And you can also see on the top there are numbers. And that's because we had to hire a company called Tracker. And if one of our vehicles got stolen, they sent out a helicopter and they could immediately find it. And it only happened once, so that wasn't bad over a three-year period. So where did all this lead? So all of this resulted in a lot of HIV tests. And as you can see, the difference between the CBVCT and the SVCT communities, the community-based VCT, the intervention, and that involved 50,000 individuals and a lot of visits to post-test support clubs. You can see in three sites, only in three sites were we able to do this. This is from process data, were we able to monitor the uptake in the intervention versus the control communities. And you can see that the uptake was much higher in the intervention versus the control communities. And this was published previously in Lancet Infectious Diseases. One of the things that we're proud of in this intervention is that we were able to achieve gender equity. One of the difficulties of HIV prevention in many countries, and including the United States, is getting men to involve. Women are naturally involved because they go to clinics. If they're pregnant, they go to antenatal clinics, and they're naturally involved in the healthcare system. Men don't have the same need and are much more loath to go healthcare clinics, and therefore the same thing doesn't happen. But we are able to involve men and reach out to men. We also reached a relatively young group of clients. As you can see in the three African sites, Zimbabwe, Tanzania, and Soweto, the average age was around 28 to 30, and Vulindlela was much younger, around 21. We saw very little contamination, if you will, or bleed over from the percent of people using the mobile VCT. So one of the things that one worries about in a study like this, of course, is that people from the control communities will come to the intervention communities. And in the post-intervention assessment, we saw that there was not that kind of bleed over. The most was in Zimbabwe, but also in Tanzania, but not to such an extent that we would worry about it. Now, let me talk a minute about the way we designed the study. So we had a baseline, we didn't want to just look at people who participated. We wanted to look at the entire community and see, did this intervention have an impact on the entire community? Now, in order to do that, then, what we had to do was draw a probability sample of the community. And so we hired companies. They would fly over. They would take pictures. We would number the households. You randomly select the households, send out field workers. They go to the house. Will your household participate? Talking to the head of the household, if they said yes, then we would interview everyone between 18 and 32. That was the baseline, and we drew an entirely different sample in the post-intervention assessment. And so the comparison, you see baseline and the B and the post with the P, and you can see there was an overall increase in both intervention and control communities, but the increase was higher in the intervention. We went up to 32% and only up to 26% here, for a 25% difference in the overall population. But the intervention increased testing by 45% among men and 15% among women. So it really had the impact among men, and that's just by making it accessible. You know, people say, why is it that people have such a hard time? Why don't they access health services? Well, because it's inconvenient. It takes a lot of time. It might take a day. Well, that's a day you could be working or doing something else. Or if you've got to watch the kids, who's going to watch the kids? You've got to take them with you. It might mean getting there and getting back. So the idea was to remove those barriers, take it to people, and the biggest impact was among men. So here we see, among the men, we went from very low baselines, overall 8%, and it doubled in the control communities, went from 9% and almost tripled in the intervention communities for a ratio of 1.45 or 45% higher. Very highly significant. So that's where we really made a difference. And you can see already the baselines were high among the women, and that's because during this time they had implemented routine HIV testing at the antenatal clinics. So we did have a significant increase, but not as significant among the women. We were also able to encourage repeat testing, and you can see it growing over time. And you can see that the post-test support events were very, very popular with almost, as we said, about 140,000 visits to the post-test support groups. Now, the primary outcome, and this is really important to try to grasp, was HIV incidence evaluated at the community level. This is regardless of whether or not people participated in our intervention. Outcomes were evaluated at the end of the intervention among a probability sample of about 55,000 people, down here, who were 18 to 32 years of age, we got an overall 89% response rate. Can you imagine that happening here? If you went door to door and asked people to participate, it wouldn't happen. But people were eager. People were happy to participate. Incident infections, and this is where we also evolved a lot of new science, were estimated using this multi-assay algorithm. And it's been very difficult to detect incidents, that is, what's the rate of new infections over a period of time, using just a cross-sectional sample. The typical design is you have to follow a cohort over a period of time. Well, we figured out a way to do it by just doing the incidence estimate. So here you see the prevalence and estimated incidence. In Soweto, about 14% in the community, with an estimated incidence of about 1.2%. In Vulinglele, in the Zulu country, the prevalence was 31%. And this is consistent with every bit of data, that the prevalence there is just sky high, and the incidence was almost 4% per year. So 4% of uninfected people were getting infected every year. Lower in Zimbabwe, about on par with Soweto, lower in Tanzania, and almost non-existent in Thailand. So here are the overall outcomes in terms of acquisition of new infections in entire communities. So overall, we saw about a 14%. The effect was 80.86. So that means a 14% reduction in infections in the intervention communities relative to the control communities. That was significant at the 0.08 level. So it didn't pass the magic mark of 0.05, but it was substantial given the fact that it was looking at the entire community. We saw a slightly increased effect of 25% reduction, significant at the point, also at the 0.08 level, among those 25 to 32 years of age. But the biggest effect was in women 25 to 32, where we saw a 30% reduction and significant beyond the 0.01 level. So we think that that's a valuable effect. And what can envision is, given the changes in risk behavior among men, given the reductions among men, it may have had some salutary effect for the women in those communities. We saw an almost fourfold increase in the detection of previously undiagnosed HIV cases. We saw reductions in sexual risk. Number of sexual partners were lower in the intervention versus the control communities. Number of sexual partners reported by HIV-positive men lower by 18%. So it was especially effective among HIV-positive men. We saw reductions in multiple sexual partners, and again, especially in HIV-infected men, and no increase in negative effects of the intervention in communities. Now, it's been a good couple of years for HIV prevention. The toolbox is getting more strategies. We have condoms. We have access to clean needles. We have drug treatment. We have counseling and testing for HIV. We have societal and policy changes. Great results in prevention of mother-to-child transmission. Virtually every case of mother-to-child transmission could be prevented if the mother was on treatment. It's a major advance. And advances in the use of antiretroviral therapy for prevention. As we mentioned before, prevention of mother-to-child transmission, treatment is prevention. And what we see in a clinical trial is that when you start treating HIV earlier, you reduce transmission to the uninfected partner by 92 to 97%. Incredibly effective. It just makes sense. No virus in the blood, it doesn't transmit over. And then we've tried pre-exposure prophylaxis. That is, whether it's in a kind of a gel form where it can be put into the vagina on a regular basis or before and after sex, or in pill form where you take anti-HIV drugs daily, it also prevents acquisition of new HIV infections. That's for uninfected people. Now, we're having a hard enough time keeping up giving drugs to infected people, let alone giving it to uninfected people. So whether pre-exposure prophylaxis will have any public health benefit remains to be seen, but we know the treatment is good. But we also know it's hard to deliver. So this is the pre-exposure prophylaxis model. That is, you give people the anti-HIV drugs before they're exposed to HIV. So what have we learned about all this? Well, we know from all the trials of treatment, treatment as prevention, and pre-exposure prophylaxis, that the biggest deterrent to their efficacy is adherence and access. So it's back to behavior. Pills don't do any good if they sit on your counter. Pills don't do any good if you give them to somebody else. So for the uninfected, we need to mobilize communities. We need to get the communities involved. We need to encourage testing. For the uninfected, behavioral risk reduction still makes sense. And now they can access strategies and devices. If they inject drugs, they can get clean needles. They can go to drug treatment. They perhaps can use pre-exposure prophylaxis. For the infected, changing their behavior also makes sense, as well as care and treatment. But for all of that, we need support. And people need supportive strategies to make this work on a community level. So what are the implications? It means that we can implement the intervention in entire communities. This has not been demonstrated before. We can achieve process goals, although it requires a fair bit of attention and effort. We can produce outcomes for entire communities that are somewhat meaningful, not as effective, not as, you know, home runs as we would have liked. We can reach men and young people with HIV preventive interventions. We can increase testing and identification of previously undiagnosed cases of HIV infection. And we can produce modest reductions in HIV incidence, suggesting that the addition of other components, things that we found out about since then, referral and maintenance and care, early treatment, might be successful in achieving greater reductions in HIV incidence in entire communities. And that's what the next group of studies are. Community randomized studies saying, okay, if we do everything we did, plus pre-exposure prophylaxis, male circumcision, early referral to treatment, getting people on drugs, can you bring down incidence to an even greater degree? Should be able to, and that's the hope. And there are two studies going into the field to show that. So we now have combination HIV prevention, of course, behavioral interventions, male condoms, female condoms, treatment of sexually transmitted infections, male circumcision, microbicides for women, treatment for prevention, behavioral positive prevention, that is, encouraging HIV-infected people to reduce their risk, pre-exposure prophylaxis, post-exposure prophylaxis, and vaccines, which remain the holy grail. As we know, it's made an incredible, they've made incredible advances against other infectious diseases and has yet to be proven for HIV. So we now have all these things in the toolbox, and the trick is to combine those in community-level interventions that really make a difference. And we have HIV counseling and testing. We had incredible collaborators all over the world and great support from our friends in the U.S. government. And we thank everybody for this massive effort. It was an incredible experience, and I feel myself privileged to be able to do work like this and hopefully have it make a difference as we sort of march toward not only better treatment, but also better prevention of HIV. Thank you very much. So we do have time for questions.
I was curious about the way you found out about the bleed over, people going from one community to another. How did you track them? Did they have ID cards? Did you have digital phone numbers?
Not in this case. We simply asked them a question. So it was really comparing the control communities with the intervention communities. Where did you get tested most recently? Where did you get tested before that? And if they mentioned the mobile VCT site, we asked them to recognize, you know, we showed them three different brands, and we said, do you recognize any of them? Or which of these did you get tested at? So it was that simple. We didn't use any mobile devices or anything, or GPS devices. We did use GPS quite extensively, though. You know, after we numbered the households and we randomly selected the households, we did do GPS to GPS because, you know, there are no street addresses or anything like that. So that's how you have to identify the household. Once that household is selected, then you had to track if you went there and knocked on the door and nobody was home, or the head of the household wasn't home, you had to go back. Or if the person who was supposed to participate in the survey, the head of the household said, sure, fine, and then you had to go to the next level and really recruit the individual, you had to go back. So we did GPS everything, and that really helped us a lot. But there's no doubt about it, cell phones, other mobile technologies are really important for this kind of work because it turns out to be one of the best ways to try to get hold of people. Yeah?
I was just curious to know why you chose those four countries, I mean South Africa, Tanzania, Zimbabwe, and Thailand.
We assumed that they had high enough prevalence. We assumed that they had high enough incidence. And we had good collaborations there and people who could help us access the communities. In retrospect, it would have been better if we had higher incidence sites because they didn't come as high as we would have expected. But it was really a function of those two things. We thought, you know, based on the best evidence we had, we thought that the prevalence would be high. And you have to understand, when you look at prevalence and incidence figures, quite often, you know, they are based on select samples. They may be women at antenatal clinics. Well, women who are getting pregnant are more likely more sexually active than other women. And so they may not represent the population. And what we did was get true population estimates, which turned out to be quite a bit lower than prevalence estimates derived from special populations.
I know that you mentioned treatment as prevention. I see that the majority of this, the study was focused on prevention. I was curious if there were any linkage to care components which were considered, and what kind of strategies did you use for that?
Well, of course, when we started, there wasn't much care. So as the study evolved, more care opportunities came in. So what we offered to participants at the mobile testing sites was kind of a fast pass. So if they were diagnosed with HIV, we could give them a fast pass that would allow them, if you will, to get the earliest, to go to the head of the queue at the local treatment centers. And we worked with the local treatment centers to make sure that people did get to the head of the queue. As I say, in various places and at various times, there was quite a bit of different access. Soweto access was quite good. It's an urban setting, and there's a big hospital there. The hospital is part of the university. They do a lot of HIV research there. They were well equipped to start. Rural Tanzania, it took a lot longer. In fact, in order to do the study, we had to establish the testing sites even in the control communities. They didn't even have testing sites. So, and then treatment was much later to come in. Again, in Soweto, it was much easier to find treatment, you know, without traveling too far. In rural Tanzania, you had to go quite far. So it varied quite a bit.
Thank you, Dr. Kutsu. It was a wonderful talk, and I know there's a line of people waiting to see the video for this, including Jerry.
Oh, okay.
In terms of kind of global health research knowledge, could you summarize maybe the most important point, a lesson that you've learned in the 10 years doing this in 1 minute and something to tell us?
Well, so if we think about low, middle, and high-income countries, the causes of disability and death vary. And I put them into three categories. Bugs are a big one, and low-income countries. The other thing that is very disabling and causes a lot of death in low and middle-income countries is trauma. So you think of the three Bs. There's bugs, and there's buses. And there's no emergency response system in most low- and middle-income countries. So if you get hit by a car, you're kind of out of luck, unless people can take care of you. When you get to high-income countries, it's the third B, which I call burgers. And you know, we suffer from the diseases of over-nutrition, but also other behavioral diseases, tobacco use, alcohol use, et cetera, et cetera. So you see this change over time. So in terms of global health priorities, what we're seeing is, particularly in middle-income countries, countries like South Africa, countries like Thailand, countries like Brazil, countries like certain parts of the Middle East, is the blending of the two. Some of the diseases of low-income countries remain, while the diseases of middle and high-income countries are coming to fore. Now, I heard a very provocative talk called Ezekiel Emanuel at Global Health Day. He maintains that if the U.S. is going to invest, let's have the U.S. invest in the diseases of low-income countries, because that's where we can get the most bang for the buck, and that's where there's the most need. If countries are migrating to become middle and high-income countries, maybe they can take care of the chronic diseases. Maybe they should set up emergency response systems. We can provide technical assistance, but whether or not we should be paying for it is a whole other question. And as PEPFAR evolves, this is one of the things they're asking. Countries like South Africa that have resources, or Brazil, start contributing. You've got money, and you need to start putting your own money into this project. So one can come down on various sides of this problem. Certainly the low-income countries, still infectious diseases are a big problem. Middle-income countries, it's a blend of the two. In high-income countries, it's more the latter. It's more the burger side of things. But if you think about it, this model, I mean, it's a simple, simplistic model, but it kind of works for any disease. You need to mobilize communities. You need people to know what's going on with them. If people don't have the disease, changing behavior, and if there are other accesses, other strategies that they can access, great. You know, you can go to Jenny Craig or do other things. For those who have the disease, treatment is important, whether it be an infectious disease or a chronic disease, and again, changing behavior is important. But in order for all that to happen, you have to have support. There has to be community support. Now, we've poured a lot of money into HIV. It was a national and international emergency. It still is in many ways. An unparalleled plague. Now we need to do the same for other diseases and other conditions. How we make those decisions, given the fact that we do have limited resources, is a difficult policy decision. Some of it moves on passion. It doesn't always move on numbers or statistics. I'd rather have the argument with the numbers and statistics without them, but that doesn't always move policy. Personal stories make a difference. And as we've seen in the events of the last month, the last several months, the gun control discussions, or the now the discussions on terrorism, the problem is these are rare events, and they don't happen all the time, and it's hard to make stop rare events, because they happen against the backdrop of a lot of people going about their daily business and just doing their thing. So how do you stop something like the killings in Connecticut? Well, it's a rare event. And, you know, the other argument that people throw at you in terms of policy changes, and I had this argument with a person delivering room service. She said, well, I don't think gun control makes any difference because it's not going to stop people from using guns to kill other people. I said, that's a very interesting argument. So outlawing murder isn't very effective because it doesn't stop all cases of murder. So I guess we should throw out the anti-murder laws. Yeah. You've been listening to, what's his name, the NRA guy too long. And she got a little irritated with me, and I said, well, that's all right. You don't get a tip then. The policy, you need the data. You need to be able to say, yeah, there are fewer deaths by gun in Connecticut than in many other states, and they have very tough gun control laws. You need to be able to say that. But it's the emotions and the stories that make the difference in terms of moving people to actually make the policy changes. And, you know, it's really that we as people in public health, we want to do the science, you want to have the science there, but then we also need to be able to translate that into ways that make a difference to those who control the resources and make the laws. And I think we've learned something about how to do that through the HIV epidemic, through other organizations like Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Other kinds of campaigns have really made a difference. And I think we know about how to bridge those two worlds. Thanks. Other questions?
So the statistical method that allowed you to estimate incidence by a cross-sectional assessment, I think your site should develop partly at Hopkins, partly at Charles University. Was there something specific about HIV that allowed you to do that, or is it applicable to other diseases?
This method is specific to HIV. Because really what it builds on is how HIV affects the immune system and also how HIV evolves once it's in the body. And the problem is it turns out that the typical assays used are very sensitive but not necessarily specific. And that's because there is quite variation in immunological response to HIV once people are infected. So you have to continually keep the sensitivity but reduce the specificity so it's more specific. And so you keep sort of putting it through more and more filters so you get both the sensitive and specific assay. And it was a combination of the immunological as well as virological assays. The other thing HIV does is once it gets in the body, of course, it starts replicating like crazy, but it also diversifies. So you look at viral diversity as a final marker. So it is HIV specific, yeah.
I hesitated to ask that. Statement before was so...
It's kind of broad. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you. It's a pleasure.